We're all citizens of a country in which people in the highest ranking political positions in the country can lie regularly, flagrantly, get caught, even about humiliatingly small and self-serving things, and nothing happens because of it. And that's our life now. That's not just the life of Donald Trump and the life of Kirstjen Nielsen and all these people. That's our lives.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, this one's sort of a weird one or a hard one or a, it's not a weird or hard, it's awesome. But I usually sit down and record the intro to the podcast and it's like introducing you to some set of concepts or a problem or an intellectual story or a piece of history that we're going to discuss and making sure that you, the listener, are equipped with the necessary context to get what we're going to get into. But today's guest doesn't, I mean, it's a cliche, but really needs no introduction. Her name is Rachel Maddow. You most likely have heard of her. She's my very dear friend, first of all. She hosts the 9 p.m. show on MSNBC right after mine at 8. And we both work very hard in our little offices where we make our shows every day. But we do get to see each other through the television screen at that handoff at 8:59:30 or 9 o'clock, 24 seconds if I'm running late and feeling super guilty, and then like obsess over it as I go home. I get to see Rachel Maddow in what we call in cable news business, the throw. The throw is when I say, hey, Rachel, the Rachel Maddow show starts right now. So I've been wanting to talk to her on the podcast for a while, and I am not alone because we take emails at the withpod@gmail.com, the inbox faithfully maintained by one Tiffany Champion. And we have been getting lots of requests to talk to Rachel Maddow. Because everyone wants to talk to Rachel Maddow and hear Rachel Maddow and watch Rachel Maddow and be around Rachel Maddow and bask in the reflected light of Rachel Maddow because she's such an incredible person and incredible storyteller. And so we have this amazing occasion to do it because Rachel has this fantastic new podcast out. You may have heard of that as well. It's called Bagman. And it tells the story of the scandal around and subsequent downfall of Spiro Agnew, who is the vice president for Richard Nixon. And what's great about this podcast is it's a serialized podcast, new episodes out every Tuesday, telling this story that at one level exists in the public record, although they have broken new ground and discovered new things that have never previously been reported. But it's also one of these, it's a crazy story in American history that because it happened essentially in parallel with Watergate, was wildly overshadowed both in the coverage at the time and in the history book. Because everyone looks back and it's like Watergate, Watergate, Watergate. It's like, oh, right, the vice president was also preposterously corrupt and criminal. And because Richard Nixon was preposterously corrupt and criminal, you spend less time thinking about the ways in which Spiro Agnew was preposterously corrupt and criminal. Although, as you will learn in the podcast Bagman, the ways in which he was criminal, and particularly the ways in which he attempted to subvert the Justice Department investigation into himself, bears some really, really strong historical parallels to what we might be seeing unfold before our eyes today in the era of Donald Trump. So I got to sit down with Rachel and talk about a bunch of stuff. Talk about Bagman, talk about the ways in which there is a historical resonance between what Spiro Agnew was up to back then in his own criminal enterprise and his attempts to obstruct justice and covering the scandals we see unfolding today in the Trump administration. And then we just kind of vibed out a bit about our relationship and friendship, which goes back years and years and years. She's been both a dear friend and also a mentor and someone I look up to and someone I've learned so much from. We kind of cover all of that in this conversation. There is no, like, you know, new mind-blowing piece of data for me to introduce to you. It's just me and Rachel Maddow talking about Spiro Agnew scandal and covering the news. Enjoy. You have a podcast now.
I do. Well, you got one first, and I was like, Chris has what?
And then your podcast came out. I was like, oh, God, Rachel's going to make a podcast. It's going to be better than my podcast. I'm so annoyed they're making a podcast. It is. No, but it's a totally A.
We are a lot like.
Slightly too honest.
You know, but people talk about work spouses. You know, that's a thing that people have. Work, clearly work siblings.
Yes. Well, I was actually super psyched that it was totally different in format and have been listening to it and loving it. My wife, Kate, and I have both been loving it
and
learning from it. So I want to ask you how you got into it. I remember my father at one point like when I was a teenager, my dad would talk about Watergate sometimes because it's this like iconic thing for that generation of people. My dad was born in 1948.
What year were you born?
1979.
Okay.
So he would talk about it. And I do remember at some point him being like, whether he was talking or I was asking about like, how did you get from Nixon to Ford, who was the Speaker of the House? Like, was there's like someone in the middle there? He was like, oh yeah, the vice president was just taking bribes in the White House. And I remember at the time being like, well, wow.
Huh? Yeah.
And then it is true that I just like, I have that piece. I know that piece of information prior to your podcast, that this is a true thing, that there was a vice president of the United States who took bribes in the White House. But that's basically all I knew.
Yeah.
So how did you, what made you want to do it about this?
So what my impression about, first of all, so you were born in 79. I was born in 73. And while in April 73. And so my mom was home from work and nursing me and obsessively watching the Watergate hearings while I was, you know, while right. I was becoming a being. And so I'm convinced that's what made me the person that I am today. Like, that's what I absorbed with my first nutrition in the world outside of the uterus.
Ambient vibratory signals.
Exactly. Sam Irvin is really right. My true mother. So that's part of it. So my impression, I think the reason that I decided to do the podcast, because I had a mistaken impression about Spiro Agnew. I had not known about bribes. My impression, without paying any attention to it, was that it was something to do with tax evasion that was well before his time in Washington. It was something that dated back to his time in Maryland, and it was probably something that was going to get him in trouble in Maryland anyway. And I didn't have any sense that it is something that he was a crook even while he was in the White House and taking bribes. But then the reason I started poking around the story, I just basically wanted to find out if there were any good books written about it, is because I thought it was an FBI case. And I thought the FBI made the decision in the Watergate era, basically, let's get Agnew first. If Nixon's going to go down, let's get Agnew out of the way before we do that. So it turns out not at all what was going on.
No.
Part of the backstory, which we actually don't go into detail about in the podcast, but if we ever do like the 40 episode version of it, is that the U.S. attorney in Maryland didn't particularly want to involve the FBI in this investigation to the extent that they had a choice about the matter, because they didn't trust the FBI to be able to handle public corruption stuff. And because they thought that if they did bring the FBI in, the FBI would tip off the White House about it in a way that would result in pressure on the Justice Department from yet another avenue to shut the whole thing down. And so they brought in the IRS to do the work, not the FBI. And the people who actually did the legwork that forced Agnew out were IRS agents. And the IRS was not, you know, strategizing in this way that I had imagined about, like, we need to get Agnew out of there first because we're going to get Nixon next. It was totally separate, totally different thing. And so I was wrong about it in my impression in a couple different ways. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized this is a story that is not told.
The podcast is great, and I'm learning a ton about it, and it's really gripping. I don't want to cannibalize the joy of learning things from the podcast. So I want to sort of talk about the lessons of it, or sort of takeaways. So one thing that I think is really fascinating is just the idea that it had nothing to do with Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are some people who think it probably did. Like, oh yeah, he was caught up, and it's like, no.
I thought it did. I thought that Agnew was out of there because they were freaked out. No, totally separate.
The thing that I think about that is like, what does that say? What does that say? There's this sort of fish rots from the head down thing, right? So we're watching this now play out. But it's like, how is it that everyone that President Trump chooses turns out to just either be totally corrupt or not be corrupt before they get in office, but then become corrupt? And it's like, what is your takeaway from that? That it just so happened that like the most corrupt president of the United States, from Richard Nixon, at least at that moment,
the standing record holder,
like, also happened to have this guy. Like, is that coincident? Like, do you have a theory of that?
Well, the way that Nixon picked Agnew is dishy and gross in all sorts of ways. That maybe when people get chosen for high political office in a way that doesn't have democratic accountability, right? Choosing a vice president is this singular choice that presidential candidates make that tells you a lot about how they're run and who's really running them and how good they are at making decisions. It's a totally unaccountable decision. But the way that Nixon picked Agnew was basically on the basis of needing to compete with George Wallace. So 1968, Wallace is threatening Nixon's base, right? Because he's going to cannibalize white racist voters from the Republican base in a way that Nixon is worried about. He's looking around for a potential vice president. And there's a lot of normal choices that he could have made. In particular, Nixon was interested in a bunch of people who he was like close friends with. And what had happened with Agnew is that Agnew got elevated really fast in Maryland. And he had started off as a Democrat, but became a Republican because it was an easier way to get on the ballot. He ended up becoming governor in sort of a mistake. The Democratic machine politics in Maryland were in such an entrenched, bad, corrupt state around the time that he was on the rise that basically the two machines destroyed each other in 68 for the Democratic primary for governor. And he ended up running against literally a Klansman. The Democratic nominee for governor against Agnew was this ran in every election, perennial candidate, crank Klan guy. And so Agnew, as the Republican candidate, seems comparatively normal, gets all these crossover normal Democratic votes. And he gets elected. Everybody thinks he's going to be this like moderate Republican sane guy who's not the Klansman and not the machine candidate. They think he's going to be a clean up the government kind of guy. Agnew gets in there with that impression, having set those expectations, and turns out to be a total demagogic racist himself. So Baltimore riots, right? There's all sorts of unrest going on in Maryland. And Agnew decides that he's going to use that unrest in his state to publicly berate black leaders in his state, to deride them in ways that is designed for maximum humiliation, to up his national profile as much as he can. Like the expectations for him becoming governor were totally different than the way he governed. And that caught the eye of a man named Pat Buchanan, who was working for Nixon and who was looking for a running mate for Nixon and knew that he needed somebody to take away some of the zhuzh off of George Wallace, and was like, I got a guy who can give us some George Wallace zhuzh. Look how he's shocking people in Maryland with how racist he's being. And that's Pat Buchanan picked Agnew to run with Nixon. Nixon had no idea who he was. And so, no, is that the story of Agnew's corruption? No. It's the story of a different way Agnew was kind of a monster. But when you get chosen to be vice president of the United States on that basis, probably worth looking a little deeper.
Right. Well, but then that gets to a related point, right, which is like, is there some kind of inherent connection between demagogues and corruption? That, like, is it an accident that these two traits go together? Like, when we look at Huey Long, right? Yeah. Huey Long is, like, a demagogue and really corrupt.
Yeah.
And there's ways in which those things are bound up. In other countries, those things tend to be bound up.
Like, right.
And it certainly looks like the thing that we're looking at now looks a lot like that. Like,
I am a religious person. I'm a person who has a belief in God and has religious faith and thinks about things in terms of how we all answer to God at the end of our lives. And so, therefore, I believe that those types of badness are related because they come from the same bad place in the universe.
Hmm.
But that is a fundamentally non-scientific way of looking
right.
at it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm telling you, like, my prejudice on these things is like, yeah, corruption and racist demagoguery must go together because those things come from the same dark part of the earth. But, I mean, it may just as easily be coincidence.
So he sort of puts himself on the map as a demagogue, and Pat Buchanan sees, like, this guy could be our Wallace, essentially, which is interesting, too, because there's kind of a little bit of relationship to Palin there. Like, we need this person to have this particular appeal to this particular set.
You think that's why they picked Palin? See,
No, what's your theory on why they...
Well, we could ask Nicole Wallace and Steve Schmidt, who are involved in it in particular, right? But my impression of the Palin pick was actually sort of the opposite of that, that they thought that, first of all, Palin would be new and she would be a jolt to the campaign and all this stuff. But they thought that she would be an attractive candidate because she reinforced the maverick idea and the anti-corruption idea of John McCain, right? So that was that was the strain of McCainism that they wanted to elevate. And she did actually have a noble record in terms of standing up to the oil industry and the old boys club in the Alaska government. And I think that's what they thought they were getting with
her. But instead they got their own version of a 21st century...
Agnew.
I mean, her job was to go out. I mean, what is remarkable about listening to the Agnew speeches in Bagman, it's like there's not that much has changed. The only thing that is unnerving is that the only thing that's changed is that, like, it's all gotten way less literate than it was then.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he was better at being Palin than
like
she was.
He's, like, very florid and literate and almost kind of urbane, and there's this kind of, like, panache to his style.
Yeah.
But it's all the same stuff. It's the same stuff. Like the liberals and the academics and the East Coast elite and the media, you arrayed against us, the righteous, virtuous people. Like it's...
You know, it's funny that how literate he is and how articulate he is and how, like, his show-offy vocabulary.
Very show-off,
People who were annoyed with him at the time and who saw him as a dangerous demagogue at the time used to totally mock him for that, which is very interesting. They'd be like, Spiro Agnew never found one word that he could use when 10 words wouldn't do. You know, like, people went after him for that. But we see that as a great asset now because there's nobody that literate in American politics anywhere anymore. I mean, not since Obama.
But he is doing the... what is fascinating to me is when you talk about Wallace and you talk about him as sort of in comparison to Wallace or chosen with that as the specter, and then you think about 40 years of a certain kind of right-wing rhetoric, is that there really is a bedrock through line in the story that is being told about who you are and who they are and who the enemies are, particularly with respect to the media. I mean, this was the thing that he was in some ways... best at.
You know, and one of the things I think we're seeing as the sort of natural, so it's a robust through line. There's also a cumulative effect of that having been so present in Republican, in hardline Republican conservative politics for all of these years. Eventually, when you are that one thing so clearly and so effectively for so many decades, it ends up changing the country and changing politics. And I think we're seeing some of that right now, right after the 2018 midterms, with the sort of minor pseudo-academic freakout we're seeing among Republican pollsters and number crunchers who are recognizing that the percentage of the college-educated population in a congressional district is really what tells you whether or not they're going to elect a Democrat or a Republican. And to see the most educated districts in the country go completely blue, like 98% blue across the country, we should have probably seen some of this when it became a sort of Fox News trope within the last 3 or 4 years that kids shouldn't go to college, you know, that college is a bad thing, that college is this anti-intellectual, anti-elite line of argument that we've seen from right-wing populists since the beginning of time. It ultimately has an effect. And you know, we've got a new Justice Department spokesperson who's from Liberty University. And Liberty University is founded by a televangelist so that your Christian child wouldn't be corrupted by actual higher education, you know, and now that's the spokesperson for the Justice Department. Like, these things add up. They have real results in the world. Is there going to be a backlash to that? Is there going to be a resurgent intellectualism in hardline conservatism that isn't, you know, the kind of white supremacist stuff that we're seeing, which is this pseudo-intellectual stuff, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it adds up. It adds up over time.
Well, and he's not quite the first to do this. The Agnew rhetoric precedes him, and he's part of a long line. But he's a particularly practiced at it. And then it's also practiced because it ends up being crucial to his defense.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what's so fascinating, too, right? So you've got, like, all these things that are happening here. I want to build towards how we reflect on this in modern times. But so you've got the demagoguery. You've got the sort of anti-press thing. You've got the corruption. I mean, just that he's a crook. He's just, like, a flat-out crook. And then you've got the way he defends himself from being a crook.
Yeah.
Which is, like, all the tools are sitting out on the table. He already has them.
Mm-hmm. And it works really well for a long time. From the time the public knew about the criminal investigation into Agnew until the time he left office is actually quite precipitous, happens pretty quickly, happens between the summer and fall of 1973. But in terms of the White House having an idea that it was happening and Agnew mounting his defense about it and putting together the multivariant defense that he put together, some of which was in public and some of which was behind the scenes. And I think one of the things that we both argue and kind of prove in the podcast is that it was a criminal obstruction of justice scheme that he engaged in and that he drew a lot of other high-level Republican figures into. But it works to the extent that he holds on to his base, he builds his base, he creates this expectation among his base that no matter what he's charged with, it'll be a BS charge because the Justice Department is full of liberals and they didn't call him deep state, but essentially these establishmentarianisms who can't handle his rise, who never want to see a Republican succeed. And they do succeed in turning a lot of the Republican base against the press in an overt way. I'm totally in love with that tape from him addressing the Republican women's gathering. Right. And if I will not resign if indicted, I will not resign if indicted. And just that detail. Yeah. And they're going crazy.
It was just such an insane
fight. Agnew, fight.
Fight, Agnew.
Fight, Agnew.
And it's
fight.
Also such an insane line to come out of a politician as a thunderous applause line. Like, wait, you're going to be a what? In what?
If indicted? But he's prepping them. So no matter what the Justice Department does, they're wrong and I'm right and you know it in advance. And then at that same event, you've got women, Republican women activists, showing up with their own tape recorders. Think about the size of tape recorders in 1973 to record his speech themselves so they can play it when they go back home with their homemade recording, because the press will doctor the recording and not actually tell the story of what he really said. I mean, my God, it really does feel like today.
And he also is doing this, the sort of idea of the deep state, right? Like, one of the prosecutors on the case had been a Muskie volunteer at one point, and this keeps coming up in the tapes. You know, I'm not ahead of the listener. Like, I got no special preview, so I've listened to the first four episodes. But, you know, we watch Trump talk about, you know, the Mueller people are the Democrats. I mean, it's like, and in this weird way, it's almost like, oh, this is all of this is being cribbed. Like, is it being cribbed in an intentional way, or this is just the way you go about it? Like, it's literally the same playbook.
Yeah. I wonder about the president, our current president. I wonder about his political, cultural immersion. He talks pretty openly about the fact that he's not a reader, right?
Yeah.
Well, I know that he didn't read the Agnew story because it doesn't exist. And I don't think he's listening to Bagman. But there are these overt echoes, right? America First is a historical thing that he's taken from somebody else. Make America Great Again is a historical thing that he's taken from somewhere else. The silent majority is a historical thing that he's taken from somewhere else. And I don't know if that's because somebody talks to him about U.S. history and he says, I like that, let's use that. Or if he remembers in some subconscious sense reading about these things as they happened. I mean, he's a guy in his 70s, so he was around for all this stuff to happen. I mean, it can't be that this stuff is, you know, floating through the White House as potential avenues of defense against criminal investigation, and he chooses them off the shelf marked history. It can't be that it's that overt, right? It's not even just that history rhymes in this case. I mean, he's literally doing the exact same stuff.
Okay, so Agnew tries to play these cards. He attacks the media. He attacks the Justice Department. He preps his people. He also lies. I mean, this is such an obvious point, but it's actually a really important one to me, because I think one of the things that I've had a hard time with over the last 2 years is I just don't, in my life, in my relationships, in my workplace, in my romantic relationship, in my family life, and my friends, I don't have occasion to deal with people that lie like this all the time. Yeah. It's just you have to keep reminding yourself of it because it's just unnatural. Like, if I say to Tiffany, like, oh, like, did you book the room? And she's like, yeah, we booked the studio. That's not a lie. Because, like, why would she lie? But, like, if the White House says, yeah, we booked the studio, like, they're lying.
Yeah, right.
Like, everything they say is a lie all the time. And this is true of Agnew, but it does have some power to lie all the time until it doesn't.
And there's a dislocating...
That's what it is.
There's a dislocating thing that happens when you move from the world where lying is an unusual thing that would have negative consequences to a thing where it's regular. Part of the to continue your personal allegory there, part of the consequence of you living in a world where people don't regularly lie is that if somebody were found to have lied, where Tiffany wasn't just wrong, like, oh, I forgot we didn't book the studio, but like, no, I'm lying to you about it because I'm trying to get something for myself by doing this. Sorry, Tiffany. You would expect, like, Tiffany would be in trouble.
Yes.
Like, there would be a problem.
Not only would she be in trouble, but I would be, like, weirdly embarrassed for both of us that happened.
Yeah.
Like, it would be, like, I would just be like, why did that happen?
Right.
It would be so weird. It'd be so outside the norms of, like, how we go about our day.
And so it doesn't just change the world for the liar, right? When you become a person who can just... It changes the world for all of us.
For
because
everyone.
Now we're all living in a world, we're all citizens of a country in which people in the highest ranking political positions in the country can lie regularly, flagrantly, get caught, even about humiliatingly small and self-serving things, and nothing happens because of it. And that's our life now. That's not just the life of Donald Trump and the life of Kirstjen Nielsen and all these people. That's our lives. And if we don't want to live in that kind of a country again, I have no idea how we go back to our old expectations of what public and political life is.
Okay, but here's where I feel like the silver lining is, and at least in this podcast, which is my feeling always is, are they going to get caught? Like, so my feeling right now about the current situation with respect to Donald Trump, specifically about Russia and collusion and Mueller, but sort of more broadly, is I want to first know what the facts are. Like, what do they do? That's my, you know. And if they're innocent, then I want to know that, right? Like, what do they do? If they did bad things, if they did crimes, will we find that out and will it matter, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing that's sort of satisfying about the arc of Agnew is, like, he's a demagogue. He thinks he could bull his way through. They try to mess with the investigation. They go, they attack the investigators. They attack the press.
His support gets stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, like, why didn't it work? And then what does that say about now? Right? Because, like, there's some, yeah, because everyone, it's like every party I go to, everyone just wants to know, like, that question.
How does it end?
How does it end? And how does it end? And is anyone, does it matter? Does gravity still exist? If you hold a ball up here and you drop, but, like, does it go to the ground?
Yeah.
And it's like, if they did all this bad stuff, does it matter?
There are three factors, I think, that go into explaining why Agnew got caught and why he didn't succeed. I mean, he mounted the defense to this scandal, which was formidable, and which, for most of the time you were living through it, the reporters who were covering it at the time and the prosecutors who were covering it at the time had no reason to expect that he wasn't going to win. He was a very, very powerful figure. He had much more political juice than Nixon did. And he was poised to become president if Nixon fell in Watergate.
Right.
And that was the time when it really felt like Nixon was going to fall in Watergate. And he had a great reputation. He had tons of support. He was erudite. He was literate. He did have incredible charisma. He did, right? So, like, he had the world in his hands. It really felt like he was going to win. There's three reasons that it didn't win. Number one, which is the first story that we tell in Bagman, is because the Justice Department did its job at every level. You had these prosecutors working with IRS agents that got him dead to rights, that absolutely just nailed the case. Their supervisor was the U.S. attorney, who was a Republican, Nixon-appointed Republican young U.S. attorney from a very connected Republican family whose older brother owed his seat in the U.S. Senate directly to Nixon and to Agnew. I mean, he's a Maryland U.S. attorney, right? His older brother is a Maryland Republican U.S. senator. Their father had held that Maryland U.S. Senate seat before them. Agnew had been Maryland governor, right? So the whole family owes him, and they bring all of that family pressure to bear on the U.S. attorney to make this thing go away, and he just takes it like a lightning rod. He takes it and he does not pass on any of that pressure to the prosecutors who are working for him. He just eats it. That is noble and heroic and the right thing for a U.S. attorney to do. Also, the attorney general. And there's more in Elliot Richardson as we get deeper into the story. But Elliot Richardson, as Nixon's third attorney general, the first two resigning in disgrace, right? Elliot Richardson does the right thing as attorney general by shielding this prosecution from political pressure and by helming it, recognizing the national importance of this prosecution and making sure that it was prioritized in terms of the way it ended in a way that would maximize national benefit. So that's one, right? Justice Department. Number two, the other reason that it fails is because Nixon abandons him.
Right.
That's episode five. So the White House has been helping him obstruct justice. The White House decides to stop doing that for a very specific reason. And then the third thing, which is kind of the final sad denouement of the whole story, is personal stuff about Agnew, about his failings as a man and how that helps him fail as a politician.
Hmm.
All of those things come together very fast. Being essentially a bad person, losing political strength, and being up against a real oppositional force that does things the way they ought to be done. That was too much for him. But it takes all of that.
I want to talk about the first thing, because that seems particularly relevant, right? So I used to really reject the kind of great man theory of history. I think I was much more like, in my youth, particularly, I think, coming up through the left, particularly, like, that it was about structures and not people, and that this whole idea of, like, man for all seasons, rising to the occasion at the right moral moment was, like, a little, like, it's all about who controls the means of production, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've changed a lot of that. I think partly even things like Civil War history, where, like, Grant is, like, this kind of, like, kind of a drunk. He's not, and then it's like, oh, he's actually this towering, important, he's the right man at the right moment.
Yeah.
Like, how much is that the story here of Elliot Richardson and Bell to you about the right person at the right moment making the kind of right moral choices? And if it wasn't that person at that moment, things could have gone the other way.
It's a very well put question. And I think it's a hard question because there's also, you know, counterfactual. Like, okay, let's say it wasn't somebody with the integrity of Elliot Richardson who's in there. Can we say for sure that that would have meant that Agnew survived this because somebody would have, I don't know, like, had George Bell actually passed on the pressure that he was receiving as U.S. attorney to actually try to inflect what his prosecutors were doing, might they at that point have become heroic in ways that we don't otherwise see in terms of having to stand up to that, too? You don't know. But I do think that I'm sort of where you are in terms of being between those two theories of history. I do think that one of the things that you see in U.S. history is that people do become as big as the circumstances need them to be. And that doesn't necessarily mean that people unilaterally bend history to their noble will, right? A lot of things need to fall into place. But I do think that trying circumstances call on good people to be better than they ever thought they could be. And that's how you get flawed humans doing heroic things. And you see that in times of trial and times of stress. You also see that in ugly times.
I just got goosebumps because I feel like I just saw, I've known you for a very long time, and I feel very close to you. I'm getting like weirdly choked up. But I just feel like I just saw like this very clear moment of your moral cosmology, you know, about like you are the thing you said about being a person of faith and just the sense that like there's a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do. Yeah. And you're going to have to answer at the end of the day. And that's actually a thing that's distinct. I've been thinking about this a lot, that like integrity is distinct from like having good or bad politics in some ways, yeah, or ideology. Like there are people with good politics, to my estimation, who have no integrity.
Yeah.
There are people with bad politics, to my estimation, who do have integrity in the moment. And that, I don't know. I don't know how you characterize it or how you test for it or how you encourage it or what that means, because it seems so hard for me to theorize. And I find myself frustrated by my lack of ability to theorize integrity. And yet at this moment, it seems so profoundly important. Like it all feels like it's just on a knife's edge.
Well, that's why I raised the issue of faith, because for me, it is a little bit mystical. And I mean that, yeah, like sort of in a technical sense. Like I think the reason I'm in love with history is a way of talking about current politics. And the reason my A blocks are 25 minutes long and all this, because I always have to tell these long stories, is because part of the way I think we understand how to live well is by recognizing it in other people with whom we empathize. And we almost never empathize with heroes, right? We recognize with fellow flawed human beings. And when integrity matters the most is when people come into circumstances that they're not prepared for and that they couldn't have predicted and that they didn't spend a life and spend their education and spend their moral upbringing getting ready for. But when you're confronted with something where what you do will matter and nobody's here to help you with it, and it's a hard decision, and it's a decision that may or may not hurt you personally, but it's not obvious what you should do. You know, Elliot Richardson, as Attorney General, is confronted with these young prosecutors who have done noble and incredible work, and they have nailed this guy. And the reason these guys are public corruption prosecutors is because they like to put corrupt politicians in jail because they think that's the right thing to do for the country. And it is the right thing to do for the country. It is also true that the country cannot bear, as far as they can tell, cannot bear the prospect of a president being removed from office and then being replaced instantly in that second by another president who will immediately need to be removed from office for another separate, totally just as bad corrupt scheme. So what's the right thing to do there? That's hard.
It's not actually that clear. Right.
It's not clear. What's the thing that you do? You make the decision with integrity, with selflessness, and with an eye on history, and you hope that you can answer for it when you die. I mean, it's just, it's a little mystical.
By the way, for people that have not listened to the podcast, and I suspect there's not that many people, frankly, that are listening to this that haven't listened to the podcast, but you guys paint the scene really well of these three prosecutors going to Elliot Richardson's office, and Richardson doesn't know this. Richardson's sitting there. He's the third attorney general. He's got Watergate. He's the dominant story in the country.
Yeah.
The country is veering towards a constitutional crisis. And these three line prosecutors come to the office to be
average
like...
Average age 32.
Average age 32 to be like, by the way, the vice president's also taking bribes in the White House in sacks of cash. And Richardson's like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? Do I need this? I don't need this.
You can imagine him, I mean, and this doesn't come up, but you can sort of imagine him being like, please tell me this is Watergate. Like, yeah, please tell me this is Watergate related. No, it's a totally separate thing. Please tell me this is from the past. Please tell me this. No. He's like, taking tens of thousands of dollars in cash in his White House office as a matter totally separate from Watergate. And we got him dead to rights.
And we have it.
And we got it. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Attorney General. Do you have to break to go take another drunken call from the president who's freaking out about his scandal, which is...
Yeah.
I mean, no, okay, that's do the right thing.
Right. And what the right thing is. And that's, you know, there's also this question, too. I mean, I think the satisfying thing about Agnew, and I think in some ways the satisfying thing about Nixon, ultimately, right, is like the truth outs.
Yeah.
We do know the truth. There's a question in my mind as I go back to that, and I think you and I and everyone else has been doing a lot of back and forth, right, like looking back at previous periods of American history, particularly that period. Does the truth out because of some teleological force in the universe? Does the truth out as a matter of kind of like moral physics? Or does the truth out because the jackass taped himself? And like, it's just an accident of history that because he wanted this tax write-off, that the tapes were there.
I mean, I am a little romantic about the Constitution. And so I think that in part, the truth comes out on these things because these are matters of law enforcement. And law enforcement follows a non-political track in our country where evidence gets preserved. Things are archived. People aren't allowed to just take the White House tapes out into a barrel and burn them in the backyard. And if they did, they'd get in trouble.
Right.
And prosecutors figure this stuff out and stuff gets recorded. I mean, the prosecutors in the end, and we're not to this part in the podcast yet, but the prosecutors make this very interesting decision about how they are going to publicly memorialize all of their evidence of Agnew's crimes, which is something that will seem totally new to you when you get to that part in the podcast, because even though they publicly memorialized it, it disappeared in the billowing mushroom cloud that was Watergate at the time. But making that decision to make sure there is a public record, like, okay, like, that's why I think these things come out. There aren't, you know, Stasi files that get, you know, burned by the barrel when the government flips over. You know, we're not like that. We're a stable democracy with law enforcement that exists outside of political winds. But we also have to fight to keep that.
Yeah, right. That's the moment that we're in, or it feels like the moment we're in.
Yeah.
Agnew and Nixon go down as sort of villains of history. I think it's not crazy to say. Like, you know, there's not...
To the extent that anybody remembers Agnew at all.
That's right. Or a forgotten figure. But then I keep coming back to, like, I'm watching this now, and I watch the news every day.
You make some of it,
I guess. And there's two things happening, right? So at one level, there's this kind of, like, everything's unprecedented, never before, which is part of it's true. Like, there's a lot of stuff being done that hasn't been done before or said before particularly.
Yeah.
And then there's also like this kind of historical amnesia that's maddening, which is part of why I like the fact that you spend so much time in history and I like this podcast, because it's like, actually, there's some precedent here.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're right. There are both of those things happening at once. Like, we have never had a non-Senate confirmed person running the Justice Department and specifically overseeing an investigation into the president who put that non-Senate confirmed person in charge of the Justice Department to oversee that investigation. That's definitely unprecedented. Right. That said, we have had a demagogic, attack the media White House figure under federal criminal investigation who defied the Justice Department as inherently partisan as part of his defense. And it's worth remembering that stuff. But, you know, I also feel like one of the things that I feel like we've learned from the professional historians who we get to talk to as part of news right now, because there is so much interest in whether there's precedent for so much of the stuff that we're seeing, is that history isn't dead either. When George H.W. Bush was going to become Ronald Reagan's vice presidential running mate, or when he was going to become Ronald Reagan's successor as president of the United States, you would think that would be an occasion for people to go back and vet everything that George H.W. Bush did and every controversy he was adjacent to as part of the country deciding whether or not he should be vice president and then president of the United States. Why is it that in a podcast in 2018, we are the ones who are able to find the archival material that shows that George H.W. Bush was part of what appears to be a criminal obstruction of justice scheme to try to save Spiro Agnew's neck, right? Like, Poppy Bush was RNC chairman at the time of Watergate. His Watergate record is not awesome.
No, it is not.
His Spiro Agnew record is curl your hair bad. And, you know, George H.W. Bush went on to be a million other things in U.S. history, and his place in history is big and complex, but this is a deep, dark, potentially criminal part of it. How are we only turning this up now? Wasn't that hard to find?
Right, and that to me, that when George H.W. Bush makes his appearance in episode 4 as being part of this criminal obstruction enterprise.
A key part of it, yeah.
You know, the thing that I obsess over now is George W. Bush and the Iraq War, because I just feel like, and partly I think it's generational, that was so defined. Like, I was 24 or 25 when the war started. It was the kind of, in some ways, like defining political fight of my 20s.
Yeah.
But also, I think in American history is like a true stain, a truly dark moment. And there are hundreds of thousands of people that were killed in Iraq and almost 5,000 service members, I think 5,000 service members of Americans that were killed. It's just amazing to me how little that sticks in some ways. And I think sometimes in the darkest times now, it's like this, you tell yourself this, like, history has its eyes on you kind of thing, that like the truth will out and the books will be written, but it's like, maybe not.
Yeah. Or maybe because Donald Trump is the next Republican president after George W. Bush, people start thinking about George W. Bush as a kindly guy who's nice to Michelle Obama at funerals.
Which I just...
I know, it's...
Which I can't... I mean, and I'm sure, as interpersonally, everyone that I know who knows him says he's a perfectly charming, decent, whatever.
Right.
But, like, that aside, I just...
History is contested ground. You know, I got
that's the point. It's contested ground.
Yeah. I got home... So recently there was this controversy where the First Lady, Melania Trump, appears to have called for the firing of the Deputy National Security Advisor. It was this strange thing. I got home after talking about that.
I mean,
the
her
first
spokesperson
time,
definitely did call for the firing.
Well, said that that person does not deserve to be implied.
I mean, I guess
anyway,
it's true.
We've all lived through this controversy
right.
in the past week.
Right.
The first time we talked about it on the show a few days ago, I got home and Susan says to me, wasn't there a controversy about Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan's chief of staff? I said, yes, Nancy Reagan essentially caused the firing of the White House chief of staff is a slightly different thing. That wasn't a national security job. It was a big scandal at the time and everything. I said, but at the same time, people don't like to think of even Reagan's worst scandals as being all that scandalous anymore because of the way that Reagan has been remembered in history. And she said, yeah, but I remember what you were like when he died. I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, you've blocked it out, but I remember what you were like. I was like, what was I like? And she gave me a whole chapter and verse of how when Ronald Reagan died, like, I didn't have a nice thing to say about him and couldn't summon, like, the goodwill to be even nice about the funeral because all I could talk about was Ronald Reagan and Iran-Contra and Ronald Reagan and AIDS and Ronald Reagan and his other scandals. And even, so that's my own lived history that my girlfriend remembers about my views, like, within the past decade that I already don't even remember. I was like, what was I so mad about? Nancy Reagan firing the chief of staff, that wasn't that bad.
Not that big a deal.
Susan was like, girl, sit down. Do you remember yourself? Let me hold up a mirror. Let me tell you how impossible you were to live with the week of the Reagan funeral. I was like, oh dear. My own history.
I'm not going to keep you much longer because you and I both have television shows. But people ask me this all the time right now when I'm socializing with people, sort of friends of friends or... Mm-hmm. They're like, man, this must be such an amazing time to do your job.
Mm.
And I feel like my response doesn't really give them what they want.
What do you usually say?
Because my response is just like, we're trying. Like, I don't know if we're doing it right. And I'm just filled with constant self-doubt about navigating this particular moment.
More than you are at other points?
Yeah, I think so.
What would doing it right be?
I think the thing that I wrestle with a lot is like the attentional economy of the world of Donald Trump.
Mm.
And
what's the right stuff to
what's
cover?
What's the right stuff? What do you pay attention to and what do you ignore? And in some ways, like, that's the defining question of our age.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel? What is your response to someone saying, like, how does it feel to be covering this right now, to do your job right now?
What I usually say, and I think it's true, is that mostly what this time feels like is that I feel blessed and lucky to have this job. Like, I feel like it is a privilege. It's like winning the lottery. Like, this is my job is to read the news all day, figure out what I think is important in the news, and then explain it on my own terms in a way that I hope is helpful to people. Like, that is... For anybody who's worried about the news, like, imagine just being paid to do that so you didn't have to do other stuff for money. You know, like, that's great. And I feel very lucky to have this job and I will have it as long as they will let me have it. At the same time, what you're saying in terms of figuring out how to do it right, we are living in an era with an unusual president who has an unusual talent, which probably explains more of how he got into the White House than anything else.
Yes.
Which is that he's very effective at manipulating media coverage of him and things that he directs media attention to.
He draws attention. And he's good at attention.
And diverting attention. And,
But manipulating attention. That's his...
He's great at it. And so how do you do it right? How do you not play requests in this environment?
Yes.
It's a inherently difficult task that you can never do perfectly right, and you need to recalibrate every day.
Yeah.
you know, we're not, neither of us is running for office. You know, we're not running a political movement. We're not, you know, running activist campaigns to get stuff done. We're trying to explain stuff in a way that's honest and helpful. And that is something that it's just a struggle, and you need to get it, you'll get it wrong a little bit every day, and every day you try to get it a little bit more right.
Yeah, but part of it too is that it's just hard for me, maybe, and this is maybe the philosophy major in me. This is like the third time in this podcast I've talked about like something, wanting to theorize something, which is that I can never quite theorize it. Like
the challenge, or
yeah, the challenge, or like, why'd you do this story, not that story, or what the it all feels, it's partly the nature of the production schedule, the craziness of the news cycle, that like it all feels under theorized to me. And because it feels under theorized to me, I go home every night being like, ah, did you make the right call there? And it's funny because I remember when I first met you, the first time I think I met you was in DC. It was like at a bar in DC. It was the first or second time you invited me out. You were in DC and you invited me out, and I was like very, very excited, very touched that you invited me to have a drink with you after the show. And I was like, wow, this
is a big time.
It wasn't
what you thought.
Yeah. Checked my hair in the mirror. I made sure I was wearing my nice new shirt.
Make sure we were wearing the exact same outfit like we do every day.
And I remember going, and this was, it was early. You had gotten the show, and like, you know, and you were just, you were like really wrestling with all this stuff. You'd gotten the show, you're sort of trying to find your feet a little bit, and I think you were, and I'm just sitting there being like, dude, you are crushing it. It's amazing. You got a freaking television show. A television show. It's on the TV. You can just put it on. All these people watch it, and you're you, and isn't that the greatest? And you're like, I don't know if I'm doing this right. And like, I see the face, because I remember coming away from that being like, man, she's really, just like,
she's a little screwed up.
She's a little screwed up by this thing. And I can see now when I like am at a social event where like someone like opens with that to me, be like, buddy, you're crushing it. You're doing it. You're there. Trump, man. Woo, yeah, get him. Do it. And I'm just like, oh, I don't know. What am I doing? What am I doing? And I just like see their face drop. And exactly like, oh, what's going on in there, buddy? But it's just because like, it's because there's no right answer is really what I'm saying.
And it's because you care about doing it right. It's
exactly.
Because you care about the opportunity that you've been given. You and I both have this sense of like being on a tightrope. I could fail at any moment.
Totally.
I need to take advantage of this moment that I've got. This is a great thing. I want to do the best that I can. And I recognize that so few people have this opportunity. I want to use it in the way that is, right? It's not ambition so much as it is respect for the platform.
It's respect for the platform. And all, yes, exactly. And also like there's a higher purpose here about the truth. Or, you know, like there's a fidelity to something that's like getting it right in some way, like telling the truth in the ways that citizens need to know what's happening in the world so that they can self-govern. Yeah. It's like this.
But, you know, I mean, that's freedom, right? So part of the way that you honor the freedom of the press and the freedom that we have been afforded editorially to do what we want in the way that we want to do it is by acting in an unconstrained manner.
Yeah.
And when we are unconstrained and we are not driven by other people's imperatives or, you know, fiat, then it's hard to decide what to do because we're free to do what we want.
Right.
And that struggle to do right in with that amount
that's
of freedom is a blessing, and B, it should be hard. Like we should be filled with self-doubt, and we should be trying every day to unbreak a little bit of the broken process that we work with.
And comes back to me, like that comes back to the Elliot Richardson setting that office, which is that like, it's not clear what the right answer is. But you got to do your work with integrity. You got to try to do your work with integrity.
And that's why, and you need to be in good shape. You know what I mean? Like you need support. You need to sleep.
Yeah.
You need to have a clear mind and a clear heart about what you're doing. You need to clear space in your life so you can give the best of you to everything you're doing.
Yeah.
Because these decisions aren't easy.
They're not easy.
We're not walking down a path that anybody else has cut. Yeah. You have to do your best every day. It's hard. You're going to screw up. Part of doing your best means cleaning up your messes. And making a renewed commitment every day to trying to do it as best you can. And doing it with integrity, being able to answer for your actions, both on a daily basis and at the end of it all.
At Peter's Gates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it ought to be hard.
The pastor, Rachel Maddow, is Rachel Maddow is the host of The Rachel Maddow Show, which you can find at 9 p.m. on MSNBC. She is also the host of Bagman, which is a great new serialized podcast about a historical scandal that is mind-blowing, but whose details are very poorly known, told in extremely gripping fashion. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. There's probably an ad for it in the midst of this podcast, I imagine. We ran a promo. She's also a mensch. She's a great soul, a wonderful human, and my dear friend. Thank you, Rachel.
You're killing me, man. Thanks, Chris.
Once again, thank you to Rachel for taking some time to sit down. You have to understand that Rachel's process for producing and creating that show every night is the most intense in all of cable news by literally orders of magnitude. I mean, I work very hard. We work very hard to make our show. What she does every night on that show requires this level of both effort, genius, and sustained concentration that is just almost inconceivable. It's like she runs a marathon every day. And so asking her to like take an hour out of that day was not a small ask. So I'm super, super grateful that she made the time to do that. I hope you guys enjoyed it as well. We always love to hear from you. So send us your feedback on this conversation or any others that you have encountered. You can tweet us with the hashtag withpod, WITHPOD. Or email us withpod@gmail.com. We do read all those emails. We do read the tweets. And we do love to hear from you. And as you see from this episode, we take your suggestions seriously. Rachel is one of a number of people that have been suggested to us as guests through those both of those channels. And we always love to hear ideas for people that I should interview. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.